This is the VFX show number 18, Ghost Rider. Hey everybody, this is Alex Lindsay, and we are back for another show, for VFX show, and we're back to the beginning. Ron Brinkman and I, we're back where we started, and it's back. We've expanded. We had Mike Seymour and John LaBrie, but they're not available tonight. So and we just had to get the show done. So Ron and I are we're soldiering through, and
yep. And I don't know where John has gone, because I actually saw the movie with him.
There's no excuse.
He certainly had plenty of opinions when we walked out of it. So.
Well, you can share some of John's opinions in hearsay. We went to see Ghost Rider, and Ghost Rider was the new Nicolas Cage vehicle, it is a
and before we get into it, just for those of you that were expecting to hear us talk about what did we say we were going to talk about?
No, we I think we edited that out. I don't think anybody's expecting anything.
Oh, well, now I have to talk about it because I mentioned it.
We were going to talk about Charlotte's Web and A Night at the Museum, and it just got a little too old, so we decided not to. So we're just skipping ahead, present.
And I didn't want to see them, but
I saw Night at the Museum, and I kind of wish I hadn't. And I'm afraid that I just couldn't get up for. Well, it turned out by the time I wanted to see Charlotte Webb, you know, we were trying to get this whole schedule going, and by the time I wanted to go see Charlotte's Webb, it was only available like on the weekdays in the morning.
Kids matinees, yeah.
Yeah, it was a nightmare. We moved on. So we went to a nice fresh movie. This is Ghost Rider. It's got 600 visual effect shots, of which ImageWorks, Sony ImageWorks. Which Ron knows a little bit about, did about 342. So what do you think of the movie overall?
I thought it was better than Daredevil.
Which isn't saying very much.
That's definitely damning it with faint praise. But I thought it was pretty stupid. It had a couple of moments. It felt really uneven to me in terms of knowing what it wanted to be, I think.
Yeah.
I thought Ghost Rider looked cool. I thought the fire was cool. Mm-hmm. I thought the villains were lame and just really perfunctory and kind of pointless.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, you know, when Nicolas Cage was on and doing his thing, he was actually very watchable,
mm-hmm.
which was probably the thing that made the movie at least, you know, somewhat work. But
right.
I'm not going to go back and see it again, that's for sure. I don't know. What do you think?
I have to admit, I rudimentarily enjoyed the film only because I had really low expectations of it. I kind of came in knowing. I was kind of gritting my teeth going, I'm not really that excited about going to see it. But I was like, I gotta go see it for work. And so when I got there, you know, it was, you know, I didn't really expect it. It turned out fine. You know, it was a fine time. I don't know if, I definitely wouldn't go see it again. There's some movies that I've gone, like Bond, it was easy, to go see twice, you know, for me. I was like, oh, I better go see that quote unquote for the effects again to make sure that I'm ready for the quote unquote, the VFX show, you know? But this one, I was like, I got what I needed. And so, it wasn't the greatest film in the world, but it had some interesting effects to it. It had a lot of them. So Sony ImageWorks evidently, I guess, did most of the major effects, and it looks like what they pretty much did. And this seems to be the style of the industry now, is a large effects house takes on the big shots that require being glued together, the money shots, and then basically farms out everything else.
Which is, you know, it's actually worth talking about that because there were definitely some uneven effects in here, and particularly some of the stuff that I would, you know, be willing to bet was the farmed out stuff didn't look as good. And at what level does a facility balance that, you know, we don't want to do these sort of standard effect shots with the sense of, you know, the effects on Ghost Rider or whatever were Sony ImageWorks, and they didn't all look that good. You know, I mean, at some level you're going to end up getting blamed for subpar effects if you farm out too much of the stuff to somebody who doesn't quite deliver as well.
Well, I think it's important that just because you're farming out the effects, if you're keeping them internal, just because you're farming them out doesn't mean that you should that you can't guarantee them. And I think that's the problem, is sometimes this stuff gets farmed out and then it's not being looked at with the same critical eye as the stuff being done internally. Yeah. And I think
it's not like, you know, it's not like there was terrible shots in there, but there was some. You know, I mean, third week in a row, I think I'm going to complain about some of the sky replacement stuff where it just didn't feel like it was quite in the scene.
Right. Where in this movie did that show up for you?
And part of it was just because they went so stylized and stuff. But, you know, at the beginning, there was some sky replacement stuff where you're standing in the midst of the crossroads, and that was really subtle.
I thought that was, and do you think it was an effects? I took that as a stylistic choice that I didn't necessarily agree with either. But
yeah, that's what I'm saying, is that some of it was, you know, oh, we want it to be really dramatic, but, you know, again, it's the lighting doesn't quite match, and there were, you know, there was sort of edge issues. There was, you know, there was some push in on somebody's face that, you know, you could just see the little slight halo around the,
right,
you know, the matte line all the way around the outside of it.
Right.
And, so yeah, stuff like that, I'm sure it was farmed out stuff, and I don't know who they farmed out everything to, but it just didn't quite sit in there, you know. I mean, when you're in the bulk of the 3D fire stuff and the various other pieces that Sony obviously did, you know, there was some really nice looking stuff. But
mm-hmm. So,
you know, I think the blue screen. I mean, what's his name? Fonda, Peter Fonda, Henry Fonda.
Mm-hmm.
Which one is it in this movie?
I think it's Peter Fonda.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, he was on blue screen, it seemed like, throughout most of what he was doing was on blue screen.
It did seem like that, didn't it? It seemed like, let's just have him appear in the film. So
yeah, and I wonder if it was just, you know, I'm not going on location. You put a screen behind me and I'll do my part. But, and some of those didn't, you know, there were some close-ups that were, you could see spill coming in on that. And I think some of that, like toward the end, some of the... like when they were in that abandoned church, I think a lot of that church was pure CG. So you had a couple shots where it sort of felt, you know, here's a blue screen guy in front of a CG background. And it was like Sky Captain or something.
Right. Yeah. So what did you think of the fire?
I thought it looked good. I mean, yeah. Obviously they took a lot of time to get a stylized look, but you know, that's the coolest thing about a movie like this. You know, for me, is just seeing, you know, how do you realize the sort of look that comes right out of the comic books in a fashion that, you know, tries to cross over to being real but still keeps the really illustrative nature of it.
Yeah,
and I think they did a good job with that.
It seemed that they took there, and there's a great article about this in VFX World, and but it looks like they really took an approach of, we're not going to try to make it realistic in every, because if you expose, this is the conversation that came up in the article, is that if you expose for the daylight, of course the fire will be blown out or exposed for whatever is in the scene. If you expose for the fire, everything else is going to be dark. So they just kind of cheated it, whichever direction was necessary to make it actually work. And I think that worked fairly well. There were a couple times where I felt like it was a little unnatural because of that. You know, I've done a lot of fire composites, and so I was kind of like, wow, that fire looks really dark.
Yeah.
But that's what they meant to do. That was the point.
And you wanted to see the real detail in the fire. You didn't want it blowing out to white. You wanted to see the color. It really set off some great scenes. You know, you have these nice blue-lit sort of scenes, and then you have the really vibrant orange, and you get that great sort of, I mean, you know, every art director loves putting, you know, warm and cool together like that.
A couple things I found interesting about the fire was that they used for this specific effect, they used Maya as the centerpiece to control, I guess, exactly where the fire was going to come out and the simulators. But really, to get the fire actually emitting, that was all pushed through Houdini.
Yeah,
and it was an interesting pipeline because, you know, they didn't have the emission tools that they needed to make it actually work, just in Maya. Houdini is kind of a crazy application.
I love Houdini. It's great.
It's one of the things I've never really gotten my head around it. I open it up and I'm like,
Houdini's basically, you know, Shake for 3D, or, you know, they may have been around first, so you could say Shake is Houdini for 2D, but it's, I love the sort of, just, you know, wiring up chops to each other and these different operators together and getting stuff out of it. It's kind of neat.
It really is. The one thing about that almost everybody I talk to who's using Houdini a lot, and I will not say that I use Houdini or I have used Houdini heavily, so I'm not a really good person to just say this is the way it is. But from everybody I've talked to, it's kind of one of those things that, you know, Houdini can be really hard to get your head around. And I admit that's what I used to say about Shake.
Yeah.
You know, is that, you know, I couldn't figure, you know, I just couldn't get my head around it. But once you get your head around it, you can do things in Houdini that you just simply can't do anywhere else.
Yeah, it's a TD's kind of animation tool. You know, it's very techy in that sense. But,
right.
You know, it's, because of that, it's also very open-ended. It's sort of a graphical programming language in some ways. It's, you know, it's all procedural. So, you know, you don't tend to model a whole lot in Houdini, but if you do, it's all procedural. So it's, you know, you build up something by a combination of sort of forces or operators acting on it, but they're all kept in a stack and you can go back and tweak them, which is kind of neat. But yeah, I did some fire on that animated movie I worked on a few years back.
Mm-hmm.
And it was this, we went through some of the same process, I think. There wasn't a whole lot of fire in there, but there's just little talking mice carrying around matchsticks, using them as torches to light their way through the sewers and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it took us a long time to get a look we wanted, and a lot of that was we started out trying to do it with a particle system, and it just felt too distinct. And we ended up using fluids in Maya, which is exactly what they used for this as well. You get the more of the fluid, you know, the fluid basis for what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And it works real nice. And we did the same thing where we had extra particle stuff being emitted from the same area we needed it to get smoke and some sparkly stuff whenever matches were being lit.
Right.
But I think, yeah, they did the same thing here of, you know, adding a more traditional kind of particle system on top of the fluid fire that's in there.
Right. And I thought it worked fairly well.
It's definitely the defining thing in the film.
Yes, yeah, so you better not. Point of view, better make
also
it work.
Just from, yeah, I mean, you got to get this guy's flaming skull working, and that's got to be job one.
Yeah, totally. And now they chose stylistically to stay away from. They moved away from any kind of smoke. Which I think would have been a lot harder as well. But I think primarily they just didn't want to. They didn't want to mess up. They didn't want to make the screen more busy. I got the impression.
Yeah.
Which you know, I can understand that. Another thing that I thought was really fascinating was the LEDs that they used.
Yeah, that's
for
that's
interactive
great.
Light.
Yeah, you want to talk about?
Yeah,
what they did there.
Yeah, what they did here. I mean, one of the big problems that you have anytime you're adding effects, especially effects that are being that have interactive light. So when you're dealing with something like fire or explosions or anything like that, the problem that you get into is you get this issue of the flame should be lighting everything up, but it's not because it's not there yet. You shot it without that, and so you add the flame, and then you do some composite cheats to try to make it look like there's some interactive light, and
or you have to go in and build 3D stand-ins and light those.
Right,
even worse.
Right. Yeah. So there's a whole bunch of bad solutions, you know, and solutions that you don't want to do if you don't have to. And what these guys did was, which I thought was really interesting, was that they took the LEDs, so really, really powerful amber LEDs, and they put them inside the wheel wells, they were on the wheels. They put them around on the – because, you know, of course, you have an actor there, a stunt double, or you have Nick Cage or whatever, but you're seeing the skull. And so they were able to, on their head, have these different LEDs that were randomly, you know, going on, you know, flickering. And
flickering, like a fire would do, yeah.
Exactly. So the flickering is then being emitted to the rest of the body, so to the rest of the character, or the jacket, or to the actual
anything nearby, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So everything's picking up a little bit of this light, and that means that it all looks interactive when you're actually watching the movie, because it actually has some interaction light. Does it need to match up with the fire flickering? No, because we don't really connect the fact that it's flickering at the same time unless the fire really went up or down. But overall, just the fire moving around, we're not expecting it to, we don't know what that would look like.
Right. Yeah, that's the nice thing about fire is it's fairly, you know, random and unpredictable anyway, and so you can you know, as long as there's just something going on there, your eye is not going to catch out that, you know, why is there not light falling on this? So, right. I guess the impression I got from reading the thing I read about it is, you know, when the actors were doing the scenes, the stand-ins, they had some, you know, hood they put over the head. I mean, normally you'd put a green screen or something if you're planning on removing it, but I guess they put, you know, this LED array thing over their head as some kind of a...
It looked interesting, you know, or it sounded interesting. Yeah, it's an important piece of putting this puzzle together, is you know, making all this work. Now the other thing that I read here, and I'm pretty sure if I read this correctly, that there was no motion capture used in the whole film. So
yeah, I was a little surprised at that. Although I did notice a couple places where it didn't the motion of the, I think there were, you know, there were certainly places where the Ghost Rider character was largely synthetic, I think. And there were a couple places where the motion didn't feel quite right on him, the animation.
Yeah, I still think that there's two religions, you know, related to this, of the motion capture religion and the hand animation religion. And you talk to someone who's really into hand animation and they'll tell you that motion capture, you know, doesn't exude what's necessary and it's not controllable and everything else. And you talk to someone in motion capture and they say, you know, I don't understand why people, you know, you can't capture all that subconscious detail.
Little subtle movements and everything. And I think for something like this, you know, if you're doing somebody that you want to move the way a human moves, you know, most of the time you probably want some capture. But
yeah, I think that it's one of those things that I've definitely kind of built up when I see an all animated feature, I'm kind of expecting them to do it by hand, because it's a stylistic process, and so I would never expect to see. In fact, I don't think it would really work that well if you did a Pixar film all motion capture. I mean, when I saw, you know, pieces of what was that?
Polar Express.
Polar Express. You know, it was kind of like I see dead people. So
some of that was sort of the facial stuff, especially, but.
But with the motions, it didn't. There's something that's lost when you see an all animated film with the motion capture. Now that being said, I think that there is something lost when you in a live action film. I think it's very, very, very hard to do hand animation well.
I agree.
Yeah, I think.
It's with the motion capture stuff. There's that. I mean, with both coming from either direction, there's that, you know, what you call the uncanny valley, where if something is far enough away from being human, then, you know, you accept it, you know, far enough away from what you're used to seeing, because you can sort of accept it mentally as being a stylized thing. But then as you approach getting more and more real, there's this intermediate stage they call the uncanny valley, where it just feels absolutely wrong, even to the point of being creepy. And then eventually you get past that, and, you know, you have to get to the point where it's so close to being real that your brain doesn't call it out as being creepy or wrong.
Yeah, I felt like there were a lot of points in here. What I was looking at when I didn't read the article, or I didn't do any kind of back. I kind of always am trying to make sure I can guess before I see it. And to me, I was looking at that it felt like it was either over filtered motion capture or hand animation. You know, when I saw it, those were the two things that I was like, if it's mocap, they filtered it pretty heavily. And if it's hand animation, well, it's hand animation. But, you know, I didn't feel like, I felt for me, I don't think there were a handful of shots that didn't work 100%. I think there were a handful of shots that did. And I think a large portion of them, you know, didn't. I did like the horse.
I thought the horse was cool. Yeah.
Yeah, the horse.
I guess worked. the whole riding through the desert scene was pretty much 100% CG. And I thought that looked pretty good. I mean, again, it was very stylized. So.
Right.
You can kind of get away with a little bit there, but, you know, that's the kind of moment you want. You know, that's the kind of stuff you pull right out of the comic book and say, just make this look cool.
Yeah, I did. I don't know why it seems so soppy. The horse riding along with the you know, I mean, story wise, I was kind of like, oh, okay, but visually, I thought it worked really well. You know, and I thought that stuff went well. I thought that the particles. I thought that the guy who you know, the wind villain, I thought was worked out fairly well. I really liked the smoke. I mean, it was CG ish, but I just felt like it whiffed well, and with the, you know, things going through it, and you know, that I liked it better than the water fellow.
Yeah.
But both of them, I mean, all of that stuff is, you know, a lot of that appears to be, and I, from what I gleaned from what the data we got was, you know, something where you have basically, you know, you match move a character and then it's just, you just turn the whole character for both of those pretty much into a particle system.
Yeah, I think that's what it was. Is you, once you do sort of, I think they probably still sort of hand match move, you know, effectively a stand-in model for these guys, and then emit particles from it or whatnot, and then a lot of it's just compositing to remove the original character and put in. Although some of those when they were flying, I suspect it was largely just, you know, just all CG as well.
Yeah. Now. One of the other things that was highlighted here that they talked a fair bit about or came up during this process was a lot of the previs. This is a pretty heavily previs film.
Mm-hmm.
Hallen Entertainment. This is Dan Gregoire, who used to be a previs at Jack Films for Star Wars Episode 2 and 3. So he came in pretty much after I departed Jack Films and worked on Star Wars, and then so they did a lot of heavy previs for this, and I think that it's just worth pointing out, I think that this is previs is becoming, especially for a film like this, is becoming more and more important to really figure out what you're doing before you get on set.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's interesting because you'll even see, I mean, it used to be that you'd either hire a company to do previs, or it would be sort of part of the package deal you'd get with the effects house. But, you know, now there's even just individuals that sort of come on as the previs supervisor on a show and actually work for the production.
It saves an enormous amount of money.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I can't imagine, you know, all the stuff you can kind of nail down ahead of time.
Yeah.
Not have to worry about, you know, I mean, just simple stuff. Is the camera rig going to fit through that doorway, or what kind of a crane do we need to get this shot or something?
Well, and a lot of times I think that we, you know, it's one thing to look at a storyboard or have it in your head, but when you put a specific kind of lens onto the camera,
mm-hmm.
you suddenly start running into all kinds of problems that you didn't think were going to be a problem when you were when the storyboard artist was drawing it out.
Yeah.
You know, because they're just doing whatever perspective works. You know, they're doing something dramatic and they're worried about it and everything just kind of fits inside of there. But when we're actually doing it.
But then the real world. Yeah,
there were a ton.
I don't think we're there yet, but I got to believe that we're getting close to the point where studios are going to take a look at the cost of previs and just mandate it on a lot of movies. You know, I don't think it's, the cost is quite there yet where it's clearly something that you'd want to do on every film or every scene.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm, you know, if it's not happening already, I'd be willing to bet it's going to be very soon that studios are going to sort of dictate what portions of movies, you know, you must previs this because we need to know what's going to go on there and it's going to save us money in the long term.
Well, and also, yeah, what are we really buying? It's much easier to tie people down once they see that, you know, once the previs is mm-hmm. there. You know, a storyboard, the director said, well, that's what I meant. And the studio said, well, you know, that's not what we expected. That, you know, that
right.
kind of thing. And as I said, I think you have a much better chance, especially with action scenes that aren't, it's hard for previs to really get the subtlety of an emotional scene and really, really get it to work. But for an action scene, it really is all about these quick edits and lots of pieces, and all of that stuff has to be planned out. And I just find that the ones that have been heavily, a lot of the action scenes that have been heavily prevised tend to be much cleaner, tighter, and more effective.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were able to edit, re-edit,
yeah,
re-edit,
I mean, that's
re-edit.
The thing. It's not just figuring out the shots themselves, but it's pre-editing the. I'm sure there's some directors that probably don't, you know. I think really what most directors probably would want is to have it previs, but to not have to show the studio.
Yeah,
because that's they want the knowledge that it would get them, but they also don't want to give up the sort of flexibility of, you know, when you're on set. I mean, you know, you're on set and something occurs to you, or you know, there's some, you know, sort of those wonderful accidents that you don't want to lose, and you've got to be able to kind of think on your feet and take advantage of them. At some level, I'm sure that there's a feeling that some of this previs is going to be a little stifling, but overall,
well,
I think if you got control over it, it's a pretty clear win.
I definitely think it depends on if it's really a character-driven, subtle moment. You know, that stuff is not really previsible.
Yeah, there's no point in sort of prevising a two-shot or something like that. But
typically, like, there's not that many. I mean, other than a mistake when you actually shot, there's not that many. I mean, like, when you're really doing a visual effects, you know, action sequence, I mean, there's a handful of things that you can go, oh, let's grab something there. But I think that 90 to 95% of it is, you know, you had to have had it planned out pretty well. And it is just kind of on rails the day of the shoot because you really, you know, you got too many people moving in one direction.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, but I've heard a lot of stories. There's been a lot of war stories. And so, you know, and you just, and sometimes you, as a studio, of course, you want to limit people's, limit a director's tendency to do that. Because
I think the other, you know, the other piece of it is as you're getting more and more CG, and particularly CG characters, but also CG set pieces, you know, you've got a previs just to know who's going where. And I think you're going to end up with more of this on-set feedback where your previs is playing while you're capturing the scene so that the director can see, you know, the actor comped in relative to what the previs is to get some idea of what it's, you know, what the way the character interactions are happening.
Right. Totally.
Yeah.
Anything else that you noticed?
Well, just the as I was watching some of the, you know, the flaming head stuff and all that, I was thinking that because of course, you know, this is similar to an Invisible Man kind of effect where you've got Nicolas Cage standing there and you basically need to remove his head and then put the skull back in its place.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, one of the classic problems with doing that, of course, is when you remove the head, and particularly when you put in something smaller like a skull, you've got to do background replacement on it.
Right.
And one of the, you know, the problem you always have when you're trying to do some sort of background replacement is, you know, you can get this little kind of shimmer, this sort of, the stuff you're pasting in doesn't quite fit quite right, and you get this sort of little boiling or shimmering going on there.
Right.
And I was just thinking, what a wonderful gift it is to be able to have heat ripples happening right in the area where you're doing head, you know,
yeah,
background
totally.
Replacement. Just like score. Like, yeah, well, it's supposed to boil.
Yeah, that's...
add a little bit more. In fact,
I was just gonna say that when you're talking about it, I was like, man, I didn't notice that much of that because I would have thought that the fire was going over top of that. And then you got to it.
That's
like,
exactly it. It's a gift. It's just you know, suddenly the stuff that you. I mean, because you spend a lot of time sometimes trying to get. You know, a good background replacement behind some of these things. And, you know, it's not a whole lot of space, but, mm-hmm. you know, it's the difference between the, you know, the width of his head and the width of the skull in some cases, or even more, you know, like if it's around the neck or something. There's quite a bit of background that has to be pasted in there. And there's a lot of techniques for doing that for those that aren't that familiar with it. You know, there's sort of semi-automated ways of using kind of optical flow data and matching patterns from the frame before or the frame after or a few frames there, or shooting a clean plate. Yeah, although I don't think they tended to shoot clean plates with motion control or anything, or just, you know, a lot of sort of hand tracking and painting stuff back in.
Well, that's been the big challenge lately. Is that back in the day they used mm-hmm. to lock this stuff off and do a clean plate, or they would do motion control so they get a clean plate. But either way, they'd be getting the performance in front of something where they really had nearly pixel for pixel the same thing on every shot. And that's really gone away. I mean, that's, you know, a director's expecting you to just knock it right out.
Yeah, it's just a matter of time. You know, they're not going to tolerate that. And I mean, the tools have gotten a lot better for doing it. So there are some automated ways of sort of pattern matching. And, you know, unless that background is changing so much and there's not, you know, I mean, it gets even tougher if you're, you know, if you're shooting it in front of a static background, a wall or a building or something, that's one thing. But then if you're shooting in front of something that's got a little bit of movement, like, you know, trees, then it starts to get, you know, there's that line there where it might be easier because the trees are already moving anyway, and it doesn't matter if it moves a little bit. But on the other hand, if it doesn't quite move right, then it's hard to get something that's automatic for doing it. And that's where you get the guys that just can sit down and paint this stuff and make it work, the magic guys and gals.
And when you think about where that's coming from, and when you see a movie that has 600 shots, and the company worked on 304, the big company worked on 342, there's a whole lot of other shots that are sitting there that were done. You know, that's a lot of all these little fixes and all this little roto. I mean, you know, oftentimes with a movie that when they list the effect shots, as much as half or even more can be just fixing all those little things.
Yeah, you know, silly cleanup stuff.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, certainly everything that has one of these CG characters there has probably got, you know, some kind of either background replacement or wire removal or rig removal or something.
Well, I couldn't believe it. I talked to someone who worked at, I want to say Blue Sky, DreamWorks Animation, and I asked where they worked, and they said they worked in Roto. And I was like, mm-hmm. a rota department in a CG, you know.
Oh, man. Having been through that now, the amount of stuff that you fix using very traditional, you know, compositing tricks is just huge.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just a cost thing. It's
totally. It's cheaper to paint it out.
I can roto fix this thing, or I can go back and have, you know, my shader writer try to figure out why this RenderMan thing is, you know, subsampling incorrectly, and I'm getting flicker here. You know, screw that. It's just go paint this because it's four frames of, you know, problem.
Yep. No, totally. And,
yeah. No, it's, you know, I mean, the place where it gets tricky is so many of these CG movies now are being released in stereo. Right. That, you know, stereoscopic, that trying to do compositing fixes that behave nicely for both eyes gets a little bit tougher.
Right.
But, yeah.
Anything else that jumped out at you?
No.
That's it? Ron, where can people find out more from you?
Well, they can always go to digitalcompositing.com and note the fact that nothing has changed on that website for at least 3 or 4 months.
When are you gonna update it? See, every week, once a week, I get to ask Ron. Where's your book? How's that book doing? When is it gonna get done?
How's the book doing? I'm going to South America.
Not doing any effects down there, are you?
No, I'm going to be hiking around the wilds of Patagonia and writing.
I so want to have a house in Patagonia. I want to be like the Dread Pirate Roberts.
That's right.
He's the real Dread Pirate, has been retired for 15 years and lives in Patagonia.
And if you haven't seen The Princess Bride, you just think Alex has lost it right now.
Well, there's that. So anyway, this is Alex Lindsay. You've been listening to the VFX show, and we are. I was going to say something else. There.
You were going to end some other podcast.
I was going to end a different podcast. I did three. This is my third podcast today. So this is the VFX show, and just make sure to keep it real.